your favorite source for Chicago White Sox talk, delivering news, interviews, analysis, and more. This is the Sox Machine Podcast with your hosts, Jim Margulis, James Fegan, and Josh Nelson.
Thanks, Rob, and welcome to the Sox Machine Podcast. I'm your host, Josh Nelson, and it's Wednesday night, October 22nd, 2025. We have a World Series matchup. If you listen to our previous episode, Seattle and Toronto didn't finish Game 7 as we were wrapping up recording, but thanks to George Springer's three-run homer, the Blue Jays are set to host the Los Angeles Dodgers on Friday night for Game 1 of the World Series. We'll share our thoughts about the upcoming World Series. The San Francisco Giants make a bold managerial hire from college baseball and continue our offseason plan project prep by reviewing the White Sox catchers and outfielders. Both should be pretty simple. White Sox could be set already with Kyle Teal and Edgar Caro, unless you're one of the White Sox fans that's thinking about trading one of those catchers for help elsewhere on the roster. White Sox outfielders, with Dominic Fletcher and Joshua Palacios electing free agency, the White Sox are down to five outfielders on the current 40-man roster, and that includes the ARB-eligible Mike Tauchman and Derek Hill. If the White Sox don't bring them back, it's just Andrew Benintendi, Luis Robert Jr., and Brooks Baldwin. So yeah, there's some job openings in the White Sox outfield next season. So let's get started. Joining me is Sox Machine's managing editor, Jim Margulis, and returning from the Chicago Marathon and a well-deserved vacation, Sox Machine's beat reporter, James Fegan. And hello, gents. James, we'll start with you. What was it like running the Chicago Marathon?
A lot of things. Just got back from podiatrist this afternoon. I've lost three toenails, so that's cool. It's corny, and they say like you get to. I mean, I was walking in like pain throughout like the being in Spain a little bit, and it started to dissipate the last couple of days. But then I realized it was just parts of my foot dying, and I would never feel them again potentially. So, but you know, it's kind of a corny to say the thing in the marathon to be like it's the greatest like walking tour of the city you'll get, but it's true. You get to see a lot of neighborhoods, you see a lot of like. Flavor around the area, and so that part's cool. At the same time, I don't know if like Bank of America like had all these volunteers and mass produced signs for them, or if everyone is just googling funny marathon sign and replicating the 15 different options the AI spits out at them, and I have to see like the same almost funny joke 50 times over the course of 5.5-6 hours. I don't know. So mixed bag in some ways, but obviously I was very happy to have accomplished it. And at least in some small measure justified all the time I spent wasting time on the lakefront trail this summer when I could have been working or, socializing or generally just not listening to audiobooks while hurting myself very slowly. So I got the reward in the end. It's cool. They gave us a medal. They gave me a free beer. So wasn't it all worth it in the end?
You doing another one?
I don't know. I mean, it's too soon or both to be like, man, that was hard as hell. I never want to do that again. Or like, oh, that was great. I should totally do more again. I would like for my toenails to grow back and then to review my my decision after that. I also kind of like at various points, you know, you kind of got what you got, but I was like, they would have these stations of, biofreeze aid stations where you could just whip some weird menthol-y goop to not feel the pain in your knees as much anymore. And I hit that a few times, but there's some notion to me like maybe I should figure out why my knee hurts all the time. And what surgery I've been apparently putting off all this time, and maybe that will dictate whether I run another marathon. But obviously I can. I don't know how long a window that will be, so it's not inconceivable. At the same time, it was a big time suck in a lot of ways, and I don't know if I'm ready to jump back in.
All right, Well, it was great to see you at mile 22. I was so happy that you made it that far.
Covered in blood.
I hope it was worth it, though.
So. In your defense, my nipples also bleed when I watch the White Sox.
I had these cool athlete injuries, but they're the really just gross and weird ones. Instead, I'd rather, like, I kept worrying about like tearing my Achilles or something like that because my calves would get tight. But that would at least sound like an official injury instead of like blisters so bad your toenails exploded and nipple chafing, which is, I don't know, that I can't, like, you know, I can't relate to players with those ailments so much. Miguel Vargas is going to hear about that. What am I going to do with these anecdotes?
War stories. Stars, well, they're just like us.
If you would like to deal with the injuries that James has dealt with, if you think it'd be a lot of fun to lose some toenails and have nipple chafing, you can register for the 2026 Chicago Marathon. That is actually open. And I mention that because the Chicago White Sox are looking for runners in next year's marathon for White Sox charities. So if you are a long distance runner and you are looking for a team to run for, the White Sox are looking for runners to be one. What was that called for you, James? Because you ran for, who did you run for again?
I ran for the Little Village Environmental Justice Organization.
So, yeah, if you're looking for a sponsor to run the Chicago Marathon, the White Sox will sponsor you. And then you can have the same marathon war stories as James is currently going through. But we're glad you're all in one piece, and we are glad that you are back in the fold. And before we get into White Sox talk, obviously huge Major League Baseball news for this weekend as the World Series begins, the Toronto Blue Jays outlasting the Seattle Mariners in 7 games, and the Los Angeles Dodgers, I think in a very surprising way, swept the Milwaukee Brewers in what seemed to be pretty dominating fashion, especially in the pitching front for the Dodgers, holding the Milwaukee Brewers team to the lowest batting average in postseason history. Milwaukee could just not get anything going offensively. A reminder, the World Series starts Friday night in Toronto and Saturday also in Toronto. Games 3, 4, and 5 will be in Los Angeles at Dodger Stadium on October 27th through the 29th. A day off on the 30th, but on Halloween night, Friday night, they're back in Toronto if necessary for Game 6, and then Game 7 would be on Saturday, November 1st. So there is a chance that we can get some November baseball this year before the GM meetings begin on November 10th. The Rule 5 protection date for all major league teams, November 18th, and the non-tender deadline is November 21st. Important dates, but don't worry about it. You don't have to memorize it. Jim will have it in your offseason plan templates when those get released after the World Series. But Jim, we were recording our previous episode before Game 7 wrapped up and getting a chance to watch the 8th and 9th innings. One great American League Championship series between Toronto and Seattle. Very hard-fought battle. But my heart aches for Seattle Mariner fans because you're just 2 innings away from going to the franchise's first World Series, and it gets taken away by a common villain, whether he's with Houston and now in Toronto, in George Springer. Just a great American League Championship series, but still, my heart breaks for Seattle.
Yeah, I'm mad at Julio Rodriguez for chasing in that last plate appearance, you know, getting seven pitches, not a strike, was one of them. And Cal Raleigh on deck, and that's really what you want to see. You want to see Raleigh come to the plate. As a baseball fan, as somebody who has invested in the series, just to see team stress tested, and I want to see Raleigh at the plate, representing the go-ahead run with 2 outs in Game 7. Like, that's what you want. And so I felt a little bit shortchanged at the end. But otherwise, yeah, fascinating series. Heartbreaking series, like you said, for Seattle. A little bit cool that Springer was the one to deal the blow, given that the kneecap, the pitch, the knee, and then getting cheered for the injury. Yeah, just, you know, one of those things where I'm not one to tweet karma or anything like that because I think there's a lot of evidence that shows that bad actors never pay for it, and so you just I don't necessarily believe in that, but it's something you don't want to invite necessarily. It's a reminder that like yeah, it's you keep cheering for misfortune to yourself, I think, rather than have it amplified elsewhere. Because yeah, even if like you know Springer. It wasn't, fate didn't determine it. It still just, brings a lot of undue Schadenfreude back to you. Like, oh, look at those Mariners fans deserving what they get. And, Mariners fans, by and large, like, deserve to see a World Series and don't deserve, like, one reaction, one, like, kind of, I think, crowd-fueled reaction, just, adrenaline, whatever you want to call it, overwhelming senses and getting to them. But yeah, I think that's the those are the two unfortunate things is that the last at bat I wanted to see didn't happen, and that the cheering for an injury, no matter what you think of George Springer, I think enough time is left. Like I forgot about that when they cheered. I'm like, oh yeah, the Astros thing, which I guess maybe in the AL West you have a longer memory. But still, just struck me as a little unseemly, and the fact that he came off the bench and came back from the knee problem to hit the homer that put the Blue Jays in the World Series, pretty cool. Also gave me a post because it reminded me that yeah, he's would have been a much better use of a long-term outfielder contract than the guy that the White Sox gave it to. So I win in the end.
And that's all that matters.
Yeah.
Now, great post. If you guys didn't get a chance to read it, definitely check it out on SoxMachine.com as revisits the whole front office thinking of trying to dominate the market for relievers and closers rather than outfielders, which we have talked about over the years on how faulty that logic was and how it impacted the White Sox and ultimately cost Rick Hahn and Kenny Williams their jobs. Over in the National League for the Dodgers, a lot has been talked about, James, about Shohei's performance in Game 4, hitting three homers, going six innings, striking out 10. You've been covering baseball for a while, James. I can't think of another game or performance. I mean, if you even had two players on the Dodgers, one hitter hitting three homers and the starting pitcher that day going six innings, striking out 10, like we're bragging about just how dominating of a 1-2 punch that is. But with Ohtani doing this by himself, is that the best game ever?
I've been covering White Sox baseball for 9 years. You think I'm qualified to weigh in on the greatest
Yes.
performance ever seen?
They're not the Savannah Bananas. They play other teams.
I mean, I guess that the White Sox playing other teams is a segue to all of like Ohtani's recent bids for like best game ever kind of quickly devolve into complete and utter shellackings, which it's hard to weigh. Like it's a chicken or the egg situation. Like, are these shellackings because Ohtani is so dominant that he just is crushing teams with pure force of nature? Sure, that there's definitely an element of that. Are these maybe less compelling for like what we think of like greatest performance ever? Because as he keeps going, like they tend to lose the high leverage stakes that one make these performances stand out. And also, I think it kind of is borne out with like position player pitching numbers. Like the performance level goes down a little bit as leverage. Like Ohtani's not being pitched as hard like when the team his opposing team is already down 7-0 than he is if like maybe it's a tying run on and you can't really allow him to beat you as opposed to like let's go home already. The bus is warming, which kind of comes into play when he's already hit two home runs. Also, he's pitching and like you're not hitting anything going offensively. Like, yes, this is awesome. This is the most like incredible display of talent, probably ever seen. And since the game's always evolving, it's usually a safe bet to like, hey, whoever looks incredibly dominant right now is probably the most talented dominant player we've seen in baseball. At the same time, like if someone wanted to see the greatest game ever, I don't know if I'd like, hey, go watch like Shohei Ohtani like hit four home runs and reach base six times against the Marlins this one time in August, like whenever that happened, because it's a lot of just I don't know. It doesn't it's obviously awesome. It's obviously amazing, but you know, some of the environment that his dominance kind of fuels doesn't feel like I'm watching one of the greatest moments of baseball history. Certainly watching one of the greatest players. It's certainly one of the greatest individual stat lines. But it was also just like an annihilation. I don't know. It's cool. It's awesome. And I think I have to like show appropriate deference to, you know, how much we all, you know, everyone's constantly telling you we need to be acknowledging this more. We need to be talking more about this, or however much, however it gets phrased on Twitter all the time. But it's also like, I don't know, some Bob Gibson game where he like needed to protect some slap hitting like St. Louis Cardinals offense in the year of the pitcher. Might even if the state, like the talent level isn't the same, and there are other reasons why like no one could score off him. Something that has like more stakes consistently throughout kind of stands out to me in a way that like these games can't, because you know, Ohtani's almost too good to kind of give this gravitas to his performance that I would want it to have.
Is it possible to rank the best performances in a game by individual wins probability added for a game?
No, watch a game, nerd. It's not statistics. It's
I
about
know,
how it
but it
makes
would
you
just
feel.
help. Well, there's a lot of people who feel that they saw the greatest performance ever, that Ohtani did this in an elimination game.
Oh yeah, so there you go. You're
Well, I just.
arguing on both sides of your mouth here.
Again, if you don't want to just go based on vibes, right? That's why I'm throwing out there. I don't even think we can, right? Do we even have the capability?
I think it's like I would call it the greatest game, or like one of the greatest games ever, just because like what more could he do? Just in terms of, he pitched and gave up 0 runs. He came to the plate 4 times, reached base every time, hit homers in 3 of those 4 plate appearances. Like, I guess he could have homered in the fourth, but they won 5-1. They had all the runs they needed already from his first 3 at bats. So, you know, I guess no need to gild the lily, but just, you know, that's kind of how I look at it, is like, what more could you ask him to do? What more could one player do? Like, not a whole hell of a lot. And when I think about it, I'm like, I wish he could play the outfield again, just to understand, you know, it makes all the sense in the world that he doesn't, like he's already asked to do a lot and prepare, you know, in between games to start. And, you know, you don't want to necessarily want to know what taxes the arm in the outfield in between starts. So when he's throwing 100, but I wish that he would, just to understand like how good of an outfielder is he still? Like, I can imagine he'd be a great outfielder. Like, he's got the speed for it, he's got the arm for it. I can imagine him being good at it, but I just, you know, out of curiosity to know, like, how much more could he possibly do? Could he be a Gold Glove right fielder? You know, along with being a starter who gets some Cy Young votes when he pitches enough, and then also a guy who wins MVP basically automatically. That'd be
No,
fascinating.
that is a good point.
Freakouts if he like slammed into a wall over some like fly ball to right in a 5-run game.
Yeah. Like, I wish you could just like unplug it, like something like that happened, just hit power, then start over, and the game never happened. Like, that's kind of how I'd like to approach it.
Well, on the flip side for Toronto, Vladimir Guerrero Jr. is having an amazing postseason. There's going to be a lot of attention in the pregame shows and the national talk about Ohtani, and rightfully deserved based on the conversation we just had. But Vlad Jr. has hit 6 home runs that leads all hitters this postseason. He's batting .442. His on-base percentage is .510. He's slugging .930. He's got 6 walks. And Vlad Jr. has only struck out 3 times. He's got twice as many home runs as strikeouts this postseason. So this has been a phenomenal hitting performance by Vlad Jr. to help the Blue Jays get not only through the divisional series, but also the championship series. And there'll be a lot of attention, of course, for the Dodgers pitching and how strong it has been for the Dodgers this postseason against Vlad Jr. But now it's time to make our picks. Jim, I'll start with you. Who do you got winning the World Series between the Dodgers and Blue Jays?
I guess I'm going to go Dodgers in 5, just because I thought a team would get to their bullpen and expose it, and you know, I thought they would exit. I think I had them against the Phillies, and thought like, you know, because their bullpen had been such a I guess, horror show for them, a delight for others. And just because the postseason starters manage differently, hooks tend to be shorter, I thought that would be exposed. And so far, the way they're throwing, it hasn't. And they should be well rested, and they should have all arms on deck. And just like, I think the Blue Jays have a little bit more going for them than the Brewers in terms of like bat speed, catching up to velocity. So like, if not the Blue Jays, I don't know who else would get to the Dodgers. I've just been wrong about the Dodgers, so I'm going to overcorrect and say that the bullpen is not going to be a factor. The Dodgers also have a pretty good offense themselves when all their stars are aligned. And so I'll say Dodgers in five.
How about you, James? Who are you going with?
I'd say similar. The Dodgers have painted their masterpiece. They've truly only cared about October. They absolutely bloated through the season out of care. They're starting pitching, especially with Yamamoto kind of becoming what he was promised to be, looks a little, it's not the flaw that it looked like at points of the year with how banked up they were. Ohtani's finally got it going after somewhat illegitimately cold first couple of rounds, but obviously just being kind of an unstoppable player. Vlad's postseason just makes him more confounding to me. He took it to the wire and holding off Lenin Sosa in home runs, and now is looking like 2021 guy who might have deserved MVP votes against Ohtani. But I expect another weird swing back into not hitting for power at some point next season that will cause everyone to freak out again. But yeah, as exciting as the ALCS was, it was kind of like not cold comfort, but it was like, let's enjoy this because the other team on the other side looks like they're operating on a different level right now. And I'm not expecting to have much fun. So I won't be disappointed.
I'm going to be opposite of you guys. I got Blue Jays in an upset in seven games. Toronto has been great at home all season long. And when it comes to postseason experience, I think George Springer is going to play a huge part in this World Series. And that's going to be my pick to be the World Series MVP is George Springer. It's a great storyline, especially on how Dodgers fans going to react to seeing George Springer bat. Like, if Blue Jays fans couldn't handle Seattle booing George Springer after getting hit in the knee, it's going to be thunderous boos from Dodger Stadium, remembering what happened in 2017 between the Astros and the Dodgers. So I think home field advantage is going to play a factor here for the Blue Jays. And this postseason, to your point, Jim, I've been wrong for most of it. So I'm going to overcorrect and say we're going to see a surprise. I got Blue Jays in seven, knowing full well that you guys are probably closer to being right, Dodgers in five, but I'm trying to will it that the season lasts until November.
I will say that the infield, when you watch games at Rogers Center, like just plays so much faster than anywhere else, especially when they're building that the rally for the Springer homer. Just grounders that didn't look necessarily scary, just shot through with no issue. So I think it is. I can see it being a little bit of a advantage for Toronto, just in terms of positioning, in terms of knowing how to push for extra bases. Like when you see it, you watch a lot of baseball in different parks, then you see Rogers Center. That's the one thing I could see jumping out in terms of, aside from like home field advantage being kind of mushy during the postseason and maybe not really holding up as a force. Like that's one factor I can see where, kind of like the dome teams of yore with the, with the Cardinals and with the, when they're at Busch Stadium and then with the Twins and the Metrodome, just like, if you know the angles and just the speed of things, it does seem like you get a little bit of an edge that maybe doesn't transfer over when you go back to grass. But, if you win the games you need to win or that are lined up for you, then it makes the rest of it easier.
Well, let us know in the comments section on SoxMachine.com who is your World Series pick between the Dodgers and the Blue Jays. I'm hoping for a lengthy series of close games to make it exciting for this upcoming week as we enter the final week of Major League Baseball in 2025 season. Other news around Major League Baseball. The San Francisco Giants make a bold hire for their new manager. They hire Tony Vitello, the former head coach of the University of Tennessee. If you listen to this podcast on the regular, if you have read my MLB draft reports on SoxMachine.com, you know who Vitello is, and you know how successful the Tennessee baseball program has been under Vitello, winning a College World Series, being in the College World Series in Omaha, becoming a fixture, becoming a powerhouse, and a big surprise during the prime of Vanderbilt and growing out of Vanderbilt's shadow to dominate the SEC and being right there with LSU as far as being consistent title contenders. To go from college straight to the majors, though, is that's where there's a lot of shock. And James, I pose this question to you as someone that's in the clubhouse and talks to coaches on the regular, in the regular and off season. That particular jump from college straight to major league manager, do you think there are going to be other coaches upset that they were passed by someone who has not worked in the majors?
I think at this point there's an understanding that the traditional ladder for working up to a manager like doesn't really exist anymore, and the people who maybe would be upset by this or kind of lamenting that ladder doesn't exist, they're going to find it in other forms than just Vitello getting bumped. Like, it requires something that gets you on the radar. It's like, it's just not something managerial jobs. They're very rare. They open up not even as often as it seems like they're turning over. There's opportunities are still pretty limited. It's just not something you go like the route that Sergio Santos is going right now, like double A manager or low A manager, double A manager, triple A manager. I think that gets pretty rare nowadays to really see someone kind of work up the minor league level, or even just like working up the low level assistant to bench coach kind of level. Like, even as good as he is and as good as like his reputation was, especially as he's coming over the White Sox, probably be a surprise to see like Walker McKinven rise to like a manager level, just because like the former player element's kind of against them. And you know, I think the White Sox would have to be really good, and then he'd become like a candidate for that. But like, not to make it about Walker, because I'm not trying to dent, maybe Walker will become the manager after Will Venable's, you know, third straight World Series championship or something like that. But just like, it's kind of like who becomes kind of a name on their outright as like someone who gets, especially, I think, if anything, having like a college, being really successful as the helming a college program is probably more in tetragrammy as like this person could be the top guy, the face of the franchise a bit more than someone coming up through the assistant ranks can kind of earn it, where that's more of a slow boil situation. Like you see teams kind of making these attention grabbing hires and trying to pick someone out who can be this just leader of men in a way that can't be quantified, that has seemingly pulled it out of the, you know, slow accumulation of resume points that maybe used to be the managerial path. Like, I just think if you're someone who's kind of worked their way up of that, you've seen people jump it too many times to be like, maybe this is a straw that breaks the camel's back, but this isn't a categorically new kind of out of left field hire. You're seeing this all the time. Like, Kurt Suzuki didn't work on a managerial staff to get here, even if he's like catcher, central former player, central casting person to become a manager. You're just not seeing people. It's almost become some weird denigration of like, well, he's not this ascendant rising superstar. He's someone who's kind of had to pick his way there. Like, I was like, there, even like as Pedro Grifol got hired, there's a little bit like, well, no one was too excited to give him the job up to this point, where his long resume almost looks like a point against him, especially now in hindsight where it didn't work out. But
yeah, Dave Martinez was another one.
Yeah,
of those.
Totally. So I think if anything, like this shift of like you're going to see people leapfrog you in big ways has already become like the norm for a lot of coaches. And you know, a lot of the coaches I talk about, like say Marcus Thames or Ethan Katz, like those are guys who have kind of almost distinguished themselves as hitting or pitching guys, and thus kind of can expect to try to work their way up in terms of like what the top of that field is, which is now newer and shinier positions. You just look at Ryan Fuller, but isn't necessarily one that lends itself towards like you're just going to keep working up different rungs of the coaching staff ladder until you become a manager someday. I think that route has become a little antiquated.
Okay. No, that's good. That's good insight. So could we see more of these types of hires in the future, Jim, where today it's college baseball, but maybe in the future, other leagues, including Japan or even Korea?
We've seen Japan when it comes to like Trey Hillman being one with the Royals that didn't work out. Those along the lines of like Mark Trestman coaching the Bears from the CFL. Maybe some reason for it and some isolated successes that showed what they're trying to do, but ultimately it didn't pan out. But I think now it's more a matter of probably information and relationships probably driving it to where as long as you have the backing of the front office and as long as that manager can not immediately run afoul of his players in terms of just you're trying to be the new sheriff in town. You have to manage the personality as well. You know, obviously Tennessee, like he had a certain pull on people to get people into a program. So I'm curious to see if that'll transfer over in terms of, you know, yeah, they always talk about college coaches and you hear with the NBA when coaches go from the NCAA to the NBA, can they be somebody who manages professionals or are they somebody whose successes were bossing around 18 to 19 year olds who don't have a whole lot of leverage? Open question. I think baseball is such a long season and in this case will be even longer season. That's another fascinating aspect of this is managing so many more games, so many more opportunities to, or so many more, I guess, situations. Like they don't really have to deal with midweek games, when you're trying to get through a five-man rotation with injuries and, how will he handle that? So many more opportunities over a professional season to stick your foot in your mouth when it comes to talking to the media twice a day for 162 games. He can handle just fine. Like if he has people skills, and I think a lot of the job is people skills, perhaps it'll be relatively natural and he'll have a good support staff. And he'll have like a good front office relationship above him to where all the information's flowing the way it should. And it's not that big of a deal. If that works out that way, then I could see, the manager position turning into, I guess more of the CEO type of just somebody who oversees the whole thing, but you're having a lot of columns report to him, but those columns are managed by like the pitching director and the hitting director, and right. It's more about just having somebody who manages vibes more or less, or make sure that everybody's properly motivated and respecting the message, and perhaps Vitello's suited for that. I didn't realize, I was looking through his history to see what his playing history was. And this is another fascinating thing about it is that he just went straight into coaching. I didn't realize I overlapped him a couple of years at Missouri. Like he was there, 01 and 02. So that's the first 2 years I was there. But usually guys hack it in the minors for a little bit before going into coaching. So the fact that he didn't, there's really no applicable, experience to the players he's managing. So another thing I'm fascinated by, like I have no skin in the game. I have no feelings for the Dodgers one way or another. So I guess they're a good test ground for just sitting back and watching and not trying to get too wrapped up in the outcome. Cause I do want to see how it unfolds. Cause it can go a lot of ways.
Yeah. And from a college baseball perspective, obviously who does Vitello hire? He's got Buster Posey to help out, to find other coaches, to help out, fill out his staff with the San Francisco Giants. This has sent ripple effects in college baseball because Tennessee has national championship aspirations again. I give Vitello credit because one thing that's different about taking the Giants job, he doesn't have to recruit anymore. And the Tennessee program, nobody, and I mean nobody, dominated the transfer portal like Tennessee did. And how is that going to work for Tennessee in the future? Did all this momentum just stop now for the Volunteers? There's a lot of questions in the college baseball front. It'd be kind of interesting to see in how they react because they're in fall ball season right now for college baseball, and their season starts in February. And now Tennessee is looking for a new head coach, and a head coach in college baseball is that CEO type, Jim, that you just mentioned, running the baseball program, finding players, NIL, all that fun stuff. Tony Vitello doesn't have to worry about it. He's the new manager of the Giants. James mentioned Kurt Suzuki being hired by the Angels, a one-year contract. Jim, we talked about this before recording. If the White Sox are not the weirdest team, and the Rockies are right there also being very weird, but they're also looking for a new front office, so we'll see how weird that they will be. But if the White Sox are not the weirdest team in how they operate in the American League, maybe it's the Angels, because hire a new manager on a one-year contract, so it lines up with the general manager contract. It really feels like Angels owner Artie Moreno is ready to have this conversation again next year, but instead of just manager and just manager spot, it'll be both the GM and manager jobs.
Yeah, it's, I mean, the Angels are a more moneyed White Sox, I think, and that means like their problems are possibly worse. Like, you know, this is their manager search has been going alongside the Eric Kay trial, or the Tyler Skaggs. Learning more about his death and everything that went into it, and the clubhouse culture, and just the, and you read about that, and just the, yeah, the details are pretty gross in a lot of ways, like gross in terms of like how a human was being treated, gross in terms of just the stunts that they were making him do for apparently money for his drug problem, which they didn't, you know the extent of it. Just it really is like they're weirder, but also like in a tragic way. I think that there's an element of like this, the White Sox are just goofy and old fashioned. They're like the Rockies. I think they're more akin to the Rockies of just the way they operate is long, time has long passed them by. And now they just are, they're, if they weren't part of a cartel of Major League Baseball teams, like they've been forced out a long time ago, just by quality control, but because they're locked in, like the league has to carry them along, and let's see how they struggle to get with the times. Whereas the Angels are, have the same problems, but also have a lot more money. And I think the rot is a lot, grosser and darker, I think, than the White Sox rot is. So yeah, it's weird. The one-year contract is weird. You know, they say it's tying it to Manasian. Also could be a case of like, if they think they're going to miss games, like why bother paying a manager if you have to miss games, which I think is real Moreno thinking for spending a lot of money and then cheaping out in really weird places. Just this weird seesaw of thinking he's going to be somebody opens the checkbook, but then you just see a different strain of cheapness underlying things to where, and I think this has been a criticism of their, you know, drafting development of just not really believing in development or just trying to fast track guys. They're one of the teams that the White Sox can rip off in trades, which I think is a problem for them when they have to look at the mirror. It's, I don't have high hopes for this. I think Ron Washington had some weird moments with the Angels, but I also think the Angels are, they present enough unique problems to where like a guy like Ron Washington, who has a unique personality already, is going to get strange. There's a thing, a weird thing is going to come out of his mouth when he has to deal with Angels problems. And so handing it over to a first-time manager, first-time coaching staff member, I think is a strange tech. You're going to be relying a whole lot on, you know, former catcher, longtime MLB player gravitas, which sometimes works, as we saw with Robin Ventura, like his first year with the White Sox, cleaning up the mess after, you know, the whole Ozzie Kenny thing exploded. Just him being a credible professional helped a lot. And so I could see Suzuki like helping restore some normalcy, but also not doing anything to get him anywhere.
Yeah, they need more players. Poor Mike Trout. I don't know if he's going to finish his career with the Angels, but yeah, just a lot of chaos he is dealing with. So let's talk about the White Sox. Finally, at this part of the podcast, we're going to take a look at the catchers and outfielders. As again, with the World Series starting this weekend, we are inching closer to the offseason plan project season. Can't wait to see your guys' plans. Should be pretty simple for both position groups. Starting with the catchers, last year, offensively, when you look at weighted runs created plus for the catching unit for the Chicago White Sox, they finished the year at 108, so 8% better than league average. That ranks ninth in Major League Baseball for offense for the catchers. WAR, 2.5 WAR total, 14th in Major League Baseball. We talked about the fielding for both Edgar Caro and Kyle Teal. They have some work to do. According to Fielding Bible, which is incorporated into the Gold Glove voting, negative 10 runs saved for White Sox catchers in 2025 that ranked 28th in Major League Baseball. Here's my bold take about the catchers entering this offseason and even into 2026, James, because I am one to say that thinks that the White Sox should keep both Edgar Caro and Kyle Teal over to next season. So with my offseason plan project, catching, really simple. Both come back. I feel like both will get better defensively. So is it crazy to say the Chicago White Sox are going to have a top 10 catching unit in Major League Baseball entering the 2026 season with Kyle Teal and Edgar Caro?
I mean, they'll need one to, you know, drive that 5 runs per game offense, obviously. Sure, they could. I think there's reason to suspect like some falling to earth as far as like their offensive results. Like, I think Kyle Teal like performed a bit better than his contact rates would suggest, at least in terms of strikeout prevention. Like, he could, the bones of his production could stay the same and still be positive. It could be like a 110 WRC plus guy instead of 125, 130, what he's doing a lot during the season. Then that wouldn't mean like he got worse. It would just mean like, that's baseball. So I think there's still forces that could pull them towards the middle of the pack without it necessarily being like, oh, they're actually not as good as we think they are. But yeah, I think I tend to be a bit more at least bullish on Caro's future, or at least not being kind of like, this is what he is, and some of our commenters are, just because he's not like, he doesn't present these raw tools that present a huge upside. I think he's probably still will settle something in better than worst framer in the league. And I think he's shown more power than he did last year. And, you know, has some mechanical things he said that explain it pretty well. And I think obviously Teal has, I think 15 to 20 homer power, potentially. And the way he framed in the second half suggests he could be plus there, going forward. And, you know, some of the finer features that, you know, he decided was struggling a little bit just seemed like stuff that come with reps. So generally I'm bullish on both of them being able to fuel the Sox into a top 10 unit. I don't know if it necessarily happens next year, right off the bat, but I guess I'd feel more comfortable saying like top half of the league for sure.
Okay. And then for that conversation, Jim, the thought process of this is easy, Kyle Teal and Edgar Caro, they're not going anywhere in my offseason plan project. Is it that easy of a decision for the White Sox that both are going to be part of the roster spring training in 2026? Or do you feel like you might really want to trade one?
I think you might want to trade one. Like, you don't want to trade one just to trade one. And we've seen Chris Getz not trade players he's expected to trade when the offer isn't to his liking. So he might look at... or he might look at the offers he's getting and think that they're trying to be exploit the defensive numbers and the development still yet to come, and say like, you know, a team is trying to lowball me because they're acquiring the worst framer in the league, and that's what they're saying, or that's what they're presenting for their value equation, and I'm not going to trade him based on that. He's got more growth to go. So I'm going to hold on to him. The thing is, you look at last year when they started the year in Charlotte, and then Caro was promoted, and they talked about like, all right, great. Each catcher now gets number one reps. They get the time that they need to develop and to catch all the pitchers and to face all the pitchers and learn how to hit, learn how to frame, learn how to receive, learn the workload. And so my concern would be, you're just restarting that again. Obviously, I think it takes more of a toll in the major leagues, just you know, the amount of scrutiny your game goes under, both offensively and defensively. And so, you know, it probably helps to have somebody sharing the workload. But I also think at some points, if these guys are going to be number one catchers, they need number one workloads. So I could see that being a benefit to whichever catcher is kept. And I think it would be Teal based on just the rhetoric about it. But it's not so much a crisis that, you know, they have to deal somebody. So I would expect somebody to be dealt, but I could see like Getz treating or not treating this winter as a hard deadline to make something happen and wait till the next acquisition period, transaction period, which would be June, July, to maybe make a trade that opens something up. I do think like just the amount that catchers play and that neither of these guys is a natural DH to where like you'd want their production in a DH spot above anybody else in the lineup. You don't want to necessarily carry three catchers on the roster an entire year. I don't think their offensive upside is enough to like maximize that route. So eventually a trade, but we've seen Getz hold firm before. I do think like Caro, you know, going back to him and just when I watch him and when I listen to him, you read what you write about him. He strikes me as like the polar opposite of Eloy Jimenez in terms of just approach to public approach to craft. I think Eloy would not discuss anything in great detail and be more like, you know, crack a joke, do some face acting and hope that like his numbers win the day. Whereas Caro does not face act. Like he does not have any, he's a man of one expression and, very much has an answer, has a harsh criticism for himself, when things aren't going right or one aspect of his game is not going right. And so I would hope that, you know, if part of the previous core didn't work out because they weren't dedicated to improvement, you would think that Caro, on the other hand, given his willingness to look inwards at what he's not doing well, you would hope that that would win the day this time around.
I mean, I think they kind of came to the game in different ways, whereas like Eloy had like obviously light tower power and natural hitting ability. Whereas I think Edgar, you know, he's obviously has been performed well bat to ball where he's gotten plus grades on his hit tool. But Edgar just seems a lot more like got here by way of sweat equity. And like you're asking Eloy to explain something that's like been as natural to him as breathing. And I've gotten good answers out of him about his hitting before. Sometimes they were more likely to happen speaking in Spanish and then having it translated, which is what something he did less and less of in interviews with, you know, for good reason. He was proud of his English that he worked very hard on it. And so but he was, you know, less able to maybe expound easily into details in a second language. But it does just kind of speak to a different orientation where like at some point, like Frank Menachino talked about like Eloy having this natural ability to control the depth of the baseball that he can kind of track pitches and also understand kind of inherently where his contact should be like really naturally. Like he'll see, you know, a fastball off, you know, outer edge and, you know, kind of hit at the right point to spray it to right field and also be able to recognize his opportunity to pull balls. And talking to Eloy about that was marching uphill a little bit because he's like, I don't know, I've just always done it. It's the gift. And I feel like Edgar just has fewer opportunities to be like, yeah, I don't know, it just came naturally to me. Where it's like, I work for this all my life. I slaved away at this to become this good. Like he can't like pretend like, oh, you know, some people just got it good. Like this is not the way he's processed the game or his life as much.
Except he's also really young.
Yeah, like it's insane he is here, but
Yeah. It's, you know, for as serious, like for as harsh as he is, like you would think that he'd been through the ringer a few times professionally, but it's been a pretty smooth ascent for him. Aside from the weird year where the Angels had him skip high A for some reason. Doesn't mind being quoted. You know, gives you he answers the question in a way that is disarming in a different way from others. Like it's not it's it has its own charm, I think, the way he approaches interviews. And but yeah, I would like to see that rewarded in terms of just how seriously he takes everything. Like you would think that somebody who understands his shortcomings the way he does, like, should be rewarded for discussing them in such great detail.
well, like Edgar is 22, or he played the season 22. I don't know his current age is.
22.
You know, in light of like us getting reports about the White Sox getting handshake deals with 12-year-olds, maybe Edgar Caro talks like a 10-year vet because in terms of his life experience, he is a 10-year vet in terms of treating professional baseball like a job.
Corey Lee, still part of the Chicago White Sox. He has no options left. So if you do trade Kyle Teal or Edgar Caro podcast listeners doing your offseason plan project. Maybe Corey Lee is the natural backup for the White Sox. I could see the White Sox still holding on to Corey Lee if they can't find a suitor for him during the offseason going into spring training. And if they are comfortable still having Teal and Caro as their number one and number two catchers, that they could trade Corey Lee during spring training. After Corey Lee, as far as the catching depth, it's not a ton of catchers for the White Sox. Nobody really climbing up the system. They'll be challenging Teal or Caro for playing time. So for the near future, White Sox fans, here you go. These are the prime guys. One of these is going to be the prime starter in either Kyle Teal or Edgar Caro. Over in the outfield, there is some work to be done. As we talked about with the White Sox bullpen, you need to find two relievers. For the White Sox outfield, you need to find some outfielders. In 2025, the White Sox outfielders accumulated 1.8 WAR according to Fangraphs, that ranked 27th in Major League Baseball. The outfielders, as a unit, weighted runs created plus, 89. That's 24th in Major League Baseball. When you look at defensive runs saved from the Fielding Bible, again, used in the criteria of determining Gold Glove winners, in left field, not as bad as I thought it would be. Negative 4 defensive runs saved, 23rd in Major League Baseball. In center field, plus 2 defensive runs saved. That was good for 13th in Major League Baseball. And in right field, minus 1 defensive runs saved. That was 14th in Major League Baseball. So not as bad as I thought in left field. And Michael A. Taylor helped out a lot for the White Sox in center field. And right field, Mike Tauchman also helped out defensively in right field, but Michael A. Taylor has retired. Dominic Fletcher, Joshua Palacios, they have opted for free agency. So as I mentioned in the intro, the White Sox only have 5 outfielders on the 40-man roster, and that includes Mike Tauchman and Derek Hill, who are arbitration eligible. But when we had that conversation a few podcasts ago, they could be non-tendered based on what their arbitration levels are at. So not only do the White Sox have a starting outfield issue because you got Benintendi in left, Robert in center. Those two have been injury prone. Benintendi still dealing with an Achilles. And then, of course, Robert still dealing with a hamstring. So we'll see where they are at entering spring training. And then Brooks Baldwin, which I don't know if he's an outfielder. So, James, this seems to be like it has to be a focus for the Chicago White Sox and trying to find solutions in the outfield. And as far as like your thoughts going to like Mike Tauchman and Derek Hill, Jim and I talked about it. We think that they're both going to be non-tendered by the White Sox. Any chance that either Tauchman or Hill could be tendered by Chris Getz before the non-tender deadline? Because again, they need depth, and Tauchman and Hill at times did help out the White Sox.
Sure. I could see Tauchman as at least a possibility. I mean, he played well, and I think he wouldn't be valueless if they picked it up, even if they weren't set upon him. So obviously they've been weirdly cagey about something that seems like, given their lack of depth, you know, could easily be like, yeah, let's bring him back. We'll need something. We'll need a left-handed outfielder, of his competence in some form. That the way they've talked about it is the only thing that makes it like not seemingly not a no brainer, but you know, more likely than not. So I'd at least be willing to give it a little bit of coin flip. Maybe they don't want to give him a raise, and that's part of it. Sure. Certainly what chased him out of his last stop, despite being productive at Wrigley. Hill is a waiver guy. I don't think he's someone that you are for. He's a nice fifth outfielder option, but I think it's more of a fluke of his current setup that we're even kind of discussing tendering arbitration. So I would imagine even if he's brought back, it's like a re-sign on a minor league deal type of situation, you know, just from what he's been. So yeah, they lean all outfielders. You talk about backup center fielder. And obviously if Brooks Baldwin hits the way in the second half, he has opportunity for more, but I think a lot of the where he played and how much action they gave him was about trying to make him that backup center fielder option behind Luis Robert. He has the athleticism, speed to think like he could be someone who moonlights there, but obviously his outfield work, especially like securing catches more so than like even good routes, make gives it a kind of a fluky feel to his struggles. Like, why shouldn't he be able to complete the end of these plays? He has the requisite athleticism for it. Is this just an experience gap thing? But then again, it shouldn't, because as Brooks will tell you, he played the outfield more than the infield in college. So it's been strange. He looks the part of someone who should play the outfield. His struggles don't seem to be someone who's just like late to the play all the time, and that's why you're seeing mistakes. At the same time, we saw what we saw. He struggled there a lot, and it's hard to be like, this is going to handle our most important defensive position there when Luis Robert's out is, at this point, is requisite 20 to 60 to 80 games a year. So it's a little bit of a tenuous spot, I would say, but at the same time, Brooks hit his way where he should have some sort of role in the second half. He slugged, I want to say, 470 in the second half. It clearly he threatened 30 homers between Chicago and Charlotte a little bit, or at least was over 20. So I think he factors in there somewhere. It's hard to say like he is a regular somewhere given the way his defense seemed made him look a little nomadish. So they were very proud of signing a platoon on the cheap in Slater and Tauchman. They kind of wanted to demonstrate that they could do that, and they don't need to throw money at corner outfielders. It seems like at this point the White Sox are more eliminating places where they should throw money than identifying the new ones where they will. I definitely see like that could be a template for what they do again. It's funny that in terms of like building a cheap veteran platoon, you literally could just do Tauchman and Slater again, and they
Yeah.
put up the numbers where it's probably more justifiable than it was the previous season. Yeah, I could easily see, some new 1 year veterans that they think they're going to mix and match and make work this year as well.
Because if you don't bring back Tauchman, Jim, I'm not comfortable having Brooks Baldwin being the primary option of starting right field for the White Sox in 2026. Like, if, being the fourth outfielder, that's fine. Like, Brooks Baldwin, sneaky power. I'm okay if he's coming off the bench. I know Brooks is going to get a lot of playing time because, again, Andrew Benintendi has been having this nagging Achilles injury that's been impacting his play the last two seasons. As James mentioned, Luis Robert is going to miss time. It feels like with this offseason plan project for our podcast listeners, they really need to find another Michael A. Taylor in which an outfielder that you are not planning to play a lot, but they probably will have to play more than 100 games in all three outfield spots because not only is it tough to figure out what the White Sox have outfield depth of the major league roster, I don't know what they got for roster outfield depth for AAA in Charlotte now with Fletcher and Palacios not returning to the Knights and electing free agency. So I think that's like one of my primary tasks is like finding an outfielder in free agency on the cheap. You may only want to play them 50 or 60 times, but they got to be able to play more than 100 games.
Yeah, I think it's going to come down to the 40-man roster crunch, seeing who's out of options in spring training. I think this could take a long time being settled because, yeah, they could re-up with Tauchman and Slater, and entirely possible. Like Hill, I'm not even ruling out because of the amount of playing time they have at AAA. I wondered if they claimed him just because there was somebody they're interested in a minor league contract. Just maybe over the course of the winter, as he shook loose from organization and they had some playing time to fill with Taylor retiring and nobody really in this place, like Dominic Fletcher, going to free agency, somebody who could theoretically cover center in the organization also out. So maybe they looked at Hill as like, oh, he's available now. Let's give him a run for a week and then talk to him over the winter about ways we could use him if we don't have to guarantee a spot to him on the payroll. But yeah, we saw them go through Will Robertson, and then now he's a free agent. They lost him to waiver. So I think you're going to see this very open-minded, improvisational, freewheeling approach to the outfield spot, which I feel is lends an air of amateurism to what they're trying to build. Like just when it's entire outfield, it's not just one position. It's like most of them.
The whole thing.
Yeah, it's not what you want. You could maybe this is the case where like a Caro trade, they traded him to for an outfielder of equal status, would make a lot of sense. And so like that's where I think the pragmatism of carrying two talented young catchers kind of runs thin. If one of those players could theoretically be used to address a position of need elsewhere. So yeah, a lot of ways they can go with this, but we've seen them just wing it. And when you look at the free agents who are available, not a whole lot of athletically interesting players who can cover center field. Like there aren't like any, yeah, there's a shortage of like guys who can run and can't hit. It seems like a lot of guys who are just going through the 1 year contract cycle, like, you know, a Slater or a Talkman. They're just going to keep doing that. So I guess I could see Talkman coming back, and that would make a lot of sense and bring a sense of ease to the roster, knowing what he's going to give you in right field and what he's going to give you at the top of the order. So that's why I can see him coming back and wouldn't rule out offering him a contract, even though they haven't talked about it. Everything else, though, I think is open-ended for a reason.
Yeah, roster resource on Fangraphs for the White Sox AAA outfielders. They got Caden Connor, drafted 19th round in 2023. For the Minor League Fanatics, fan favorite Nishida, which I know James would love to see him in the majors. Zach DeLoach, we've already seen him in the majors. And Drew Baker, that's it. The Charlotte Knights started playing tomorrow. That's what they've got. Now, there is Brandon Montgomery, who just joined the Glendale Desert Dogs in the Arizona Fall League. Is it too soon, James, to start thinking that Brandon Montgomery could be a factor in the White Sox outfield in 2026?
No, it's not too soon. The year 2026, I think if your off-season plan project revolves around him taking, like, solving right field in 2026, this seems like didn't do the work and, like, was scribbling stuff on the bus ride to school type of desperation. Like, obviously very, like, toolsy and, you know, obviously has SEC experience and got to Double-A and looks pretty good in the AFL to start out. But, you know, talking, like, I was working a story about it. Like, he really was pretty unpolished as a hitter through high school. He's still like a two-way player there. So there's, even as experienced as he is, especially people who have high on him, there's a little bit of, there's more upside than necessarily his pedigree would suggest, because he hasn't necessarily been focused on hitting or the type of hitter having the current mechanics of a swing as long as you would think for somebody who just like played at nothing but premier college programs and raked and, you know, is now of kind of, you know, he's not behind schedule or anything, but is more age appropriate than he is like, you know, a prep player than who got into Double-A in his first full year. Would be. So no, I mean, yes, he could work it up there, because if he keeps like raking the way he does, if he posts a 130 WRC plus at every level like he's done so far, like, yeah, he'll definitely get up to Chicago at some point next year. They want him to be a fixture, and if he plays like it, they'll let him be. But I think you gotta allow like a half season even like if things are cooking for him right off the bat for him to get up there, let alone to, you know, just obviously he'd be a person who once he gets up, you assume he kind of is an everyday player when he is, but that there would still necessarily be a window between that and like he's a above average contributor and he's really established everyday player. So I think you'd have need to kind of build out both corner outfield spots. Like, you're not going to hand one to Brady Montgomery in spring training because you have no other options and everyone else in camp is a minor league free agent signing, ideally. But yeah, he's definitely part of the long-term solution there. But the White Sox need to find at least two long-term solutions, a corner outfielder, because Andrew Benintendi having two more years left in his contract doesn't necessarily count as that answer at this stage, with how much he's able to man the outfield. And also, the White Sox probably viewing their best years as beyond the life of Benintendi's contract, ideally.
And there are some free agent outfielders, Jim, to kind of come full circle with your George Springer comment. Again, there's really nothing in AAA that is challenging what the White Sox currently have on hand. It's pretty much just Brady Montgomery right now for prospects that you can realistically count on to be one of the starting outfielders when Montgomery comes here to Chicago. Do you even have Luis Robert and Andrew Benintendi anymore? You could still continue to be in this cycle where you need to continue to find starting outfielders because the White Sox are struggling right now a little bit in developing outfielders. I throw this out as the last question because I know it's a joke, but I know so many on Sox Machine are going to make very convincing arguments, and I'm with you guys. But Jim, what are the odds that Jerry Reinsdorf decides to shock the world and the White Sox are serious contenders in signing someone like Kyle Tucker or Cody Bellinger to help fix the outfield?
Say, like, only if Justin Ishbia is, like, doing a Weekend at Bernie's thing and, like, signing a contract with Jerry Reinsdorf's signature, because Reinsdorf would never do it with his own hand. It would have to be, not him. I would say, like, unless the Ishbia, with the capital contributions he's making are more than debt service, or if they are really looking to transition to a new ownership faster than the stated agreement allows, then maybe that's the only way I could see it happening. But assuming Jerry Reinsdorf is the guy calling the shots through 2029 at the very least, then you have to assume no chance in hell.
Yeah, there's Trent Grisham, Mike Yastrzemski. Mike Yastrzemski's 35. Wow. Cedric Mullins is a free agent. My guy, Starling Marte, 37 now. Tommy Pham. Yeah, this you mentioned the outfield free agent class is not all that great this offseason. So it'll take very creative thoughts, podcast listeners, on trying to fix the White Sox outfield. But I think this is going to be a continued conversation throughout the offseason, how the White Sox are going to address this need.
I was thinking like, I don't know, a No Country for Old Men situation where like, White Sox is walking home after a nice night out and happens upon a scene of a drug deal gone bad and there's dead bodies all around and a sack of cash that needs to be laundered through. Like,
I was wondering where we're going with this.
Harrison Bader contract for some reason.
Okay. And who's hunting them? Who's hunting if we're going to continue this movie?
I don't know. Scott Boras traveling around with that air pressure gun. It seems like an unlikely visual. I don't know. Something where they happen upon a stack of money and they have to be like, actually, CHSN made $280 billion this quarter. I don't know how. I don't understand a lot about money laundering.
And then clearly. They get Max Kepler.
Well, I can't wait to see what you guys have for the outfield solution. Again, it is one of the tougher tasks with the offseason plan projects, especially like right now before I make any moves and I've listed the guys and we'll talk about the infielders in our upcoming episode. That's a lot more optimistic angle for the White Sox and the outfielders. Right now I'm at $52 million for 26-man roster. Andrew Benintendi and Luis Robert take up 37 of that $52 million. And I just don't have a lot of confidence that either guy is going to play more than 130 games. In 2025.
That is the argument for keeping Robert, though. Like, just in terms of where else are they going to spend the money for a player remotely interesting?
Yeah, I guess. But if you take his, what, $20 million, can you get two outfielders for $10 million? And can they take over right field or maybe center field? I don't know. Like,
in a way that problem solves, like, you know, meaningfully, maybe not.
Yeah, maybe not.
Like, I think it's like $10 million would pay for a patch, like a decent patch. But yeah, if they're looking for just the 1 4-month stretch from Robert that allows them to trade for somebody they can use, spinning him forward for a player more useful down the line, like, yeah, there's something between a rock and a hard place, I think, just because I think any player as talented as Robert would get the playing time elsewhere for a better team. So like the White Sox being as bad as they are, I think, paints them in a certain corners if they don't want to spend any kind of meaningful amount of money to outbid the competition.
If you had the confidence where you decline the option for Robert and you offered like Trent Grisham 3 years, $60 million, to be the next center fielder for the White Sox? Would that be a route you'd be willing to go, even though Grisham is older?
It's a case where, because the White Sox haven't said when they plan on competing, like, it's really hard to like talk about 3-year contracts and be like, is it going to be around for it? Is it going to be good for when the White Sox are good? Or is it going to be a case where like, he's like the Adam LaRoche contract of, well, it turns out he's a millstone, even though it's only 2 years, they're not going to spend past it. It's a bad contract. So yeah, I think that's what makes it hard to look at until Chris Getz says, this is going to be our consolidation year, and next year is going to be, we anticipate launching, a real bid for competing. Until you get to that point, rhetorically from him, it seems like 1-year contracts or maybe 2-year deals, if you're feeling frisky, are the way to go.
Wouldn't you still have the same number of outfielders left to get if you declined Robert and swapped him out with Grisham?
Yeah, I guess. Yes, you do. Yeah. You do. It's just that you have someone under contract for the next 3 years and not going year to year. But there could be a benefit going year to year right now for the White Sox outfielders. But at some point, because of the development of the outfield for the Chicago White Sox, you just got Brady Montgomery, it seems like. So unless you're moving somebody
Brian
else
Ramos
in the outfield.
And out of options,
gonna,
Brian
you're
Ramos.
Gonna to, you're going to have to address this.
This is the redemption arc.
Ramos. But you're going to have to spend some cash in the outfield, or you're going to have to trade for outfielders. It's just, this is a concern for the White Sox entering this offseason, and can't wait to hear from Chris Getz, especially at the GM meetings, the winter meetings, and how the White Sox are planning to address this. They jumped the market pretty early last year with Slater and Talkman. Those were November signings, so we may get some answers in the upcoming weeks. But that will do it for this episode of the Sox Machine Podcast. We hope you enjoyed this episode. If you just discovered the Sox Machine Podcast, you can subscribe to the show wherever you listen to podcasts, such as Spotify and Apple Music. You can also listen to the show and watch our videos on our YouTube channel at youtube.com/SoxMachine. Follow us on social media. We're on all the platforms at Sox Machine. You can follow James at JR Fegan. You can follow me at SoxMachine_Josh. If you enjoy our work and want full access to all of our coverage of the Chicago White Sox and Major League Baseball, get an ad-free experience both on the website and the podcast, unlock the comment section, maybe even join our group chat to have direct access to both Jim and James and pester them with the questions and thoughts that you have regarding the Chicago White Sox, you can sign up to become a Sox Machine subscriber at SoxMachine.com/products. And we have plans starting at $5 a month, going all the way up to being part of our Veterans Committee. We're going to be meeting with our VCs on Thursday to talk about our 2026 plans. So again, if you enjoy your work and want to help keep the lights on at SoxMachine.com, no better time than now to sign up with a subscription. You can also gift subscriptions as well at SoxMachine.com/products. The Sox Machine Podcast is a production of SoxMachine.com. You're on for all things Chicago White Sox baseball and part of the Blue Wire Podcast Network. Alongside Jim Margulis and James Fegan, I'm Josh Nelson. Thanks for listening and watching.